the show.
Well, hey everyone, welcome to this week's show. I am your host, Lisa Anderson. We are in the middle of summer, which for me is incredibly depressing. July 1st is one of my worst days of the year because June is over. It's my favorite month, and really it's just downhill from there, people. That's all I have to say. It is getting darker. The berries are going up in price again, which depresses me. I'm not okay with it. And, you know, of course, it just, you know, you feel like things are just starting to wind down. But that's okay. We still have 2 months. Well, a month and a half left. Whatever. All right, this week's show, we've got... a fun show for you. Later on, we have Candace here by phone to talk about, answer a listener question about siblings who are marrying unbelievers. And really kind of, I think she says they're actually, her siblings are unbelievers as well. And just how, to what extent does she, you know, support this relationship? I mean, she's trying to encourage them and hopefully, you know, get them to stick their, you know, keep their relationships together, but she's kind of discouraged by it. She wants more for her siblings. And so Candace is going to weigh in on that. And then our culture, we have Jeff Scheinebarger. He is the author of More or Less, and he's going to be talking to us about what it means to choose a lifestyle of excessive generosity. So be prepared to get uncomfortable and to talk about getting rid of your junk, about getting rid of stuff that you love, about getting rid of your sense of entitlement, and quite frankly, your money. So that is awesome. And go out and spend what you can right now, because after you hear this culture, you won't be able to. So that's our culture segment. But here we are for our round table. I have three women at the table, Chelsea, Bree, and Monica. Hello, ladies.
Hello. Hello.
Okay, so this is interesting because we have three women at the table to talk about being unequally yoked in dating relationships, especially if they're relationships that are serious and moving towards marriage and the challenges. All three of these women have been there. Lest you say, why is it only women? Why aren't there any guys here? Okay, not that guys don't, this has never happened to men, but one, either no guys were willing to talk about it, or as a couple of our guy friends said, you know, it's kind of like you don't really see too many men in church with their kids, you know, because their wife now is unwilling to go. Often we see the women who have made this kind of decision. And of course, men, we know guys, when you go and pursue, you kind of have a little bit more, direction and initiative in choosing someone. And women, somehow we just, quote, fall into these relationships. How does this happen? So this is how we're going to kick it off. I'm going to ask you guys how, I'm going to find out how you got into these relationships. Because thanks. Christian women, I have never heard from a Christian woman who says, I'm a Christian, and the one thing I want to do is go find a guy who doesn't love Jesus and who is opposed to everything that I believe at my core, yet somehow this happens. So how did you get on this little slippery slope of getting in relationship with these guys?
I would say, I think it starts with a friendship, right? So you're attracted to a guy, or you start hanging out with a guy just as friends, and then that person is such a good guy, such a nice guy, and he's respectful of you, and you think, oh, he's a good guy. He's such a great friend. And then it develops easier into a relationship because you just get comfortable and you get complacent. And then you start, you know, heartstrings start attaching. And then it's kind of like, oh, I could make this work because he's a good guy. And it's not like he doesn't love Jesus. It's just like, that's just not his thing. But it could be because he's a good guy, you know? Mm-hmm. So I think that's how it starts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For me, it was just like, well, actually, I was studying abroad at the time, so that I was like, ooh, this is going to be a short-term thing. We were just hanging out. I know it sounds terrible. He was so sweet. And like you were saying, he was a really good guy. And like,
he listened to you.
Yeah. And he was just like, I don't know. I felt like we connected on like this emotional level, but I kept telling myself, it's fine. You have to leave soon. It's fine. It'll end when we leave. It can just be a friendship for now, and mm-hmm. then we'll leave and it will be over.
And so you were in Europe, right? Was
yes.
he actually European?
Yes.
Oh, that's bad.
That's why.
That's right. That's it right there.
All yep. the skeletons yeah. come out.
Yeah. Okay, yeah.
And for me, he was a friend of my cousin's, and I met him at a wedding, and he came from a good family. My cousin knew that he was a really good guy and whatnot, and so he had everything on that checklist, that, you know, mental checklist that you have for a future husband, except, oops, he didn't love Jesus. But I figured, he will once, I mean, how could you not love Jesus once mm-hmm. I introduce him to him? Mm-hmm. So, and it didn't happen that way. So I tried everything, gave him Bibles, did the CD with the good music yeah. on it and whatnot, and he was just not having it.
So. Yeah, yeah. Well, and two, like, especially when he you know, gets to know you more. I think that's too, you know, once they realize how important Jesus is to me, mm-hmm. they're going to realize exactly. that, oh my goodness, why don't I have him in my life? Right. Why isn't that? Okay. So that mm-hmm. makes a lot of sense. Okay. So at some point, now again, you know, we're talking a little frog in the kettle here. You know, you guys yeah. get into a relationship, whatever, eventually you grow closer and stuff like that. Did you find yourself then saying, okay, where am I? Where's my heart? Were you starting to justify what was going on? Were you wrestling with God in the midst of this? What was your thought process as the relationship
of
grew
course,
deeper?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, easily. And for me, I kept thinking, God put me in this place and time to be in this person's life.
To save him.
Yeah.
And what a ministry.
His dad was a pastor, so he knew. For me, I knew he knew the Bible, and he had just rejected it. So I was like, oh, it's only a matter of time. Mm-hmm. You know, as things progressed and we didn't separate as much and as quickly as I thought we would, I was like, oh, he'll get it. Mm-hmm. He'll figure it out. This is fine. It's supposed to be this way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You feel like you were put in his life for mm-hmm. a reason, and you feel like I'm here to save him. I'm doing a good thing. You know, no one else is really going to understand him like I do. And you're right. If it's important to me, I mean, it's not that big of a deal. Like, you downplay how important it is, and you do justify things. Mm-hmm. And that's a very slippery slope when you're dating a non-Christian, because it's physically the slippery slope. It's like, okay, well, I guess this isn't a big deal. And mm-hmm. getting intimate here or putting boundaries down here isn't that big of a deal. And so then you have this mm-hmm. guilt of, you know better, but this is such a good guy. And you're not having sex, so it's okay. Mm-hmm. But then, like I said, it's just then the guilt pours on, but then you justify, but he's a good guy and we're not having sex, so it's okay. And then, you know, before you know it, you're in, you know, you're boiling mm-hmm. in the kettle. So, mm-hmm. yeah.
Yeah, and I think for me, my mom had warned me against that. She said, you're playing with fire, you're going to mm-hmm. get burned. And I really thought, in a very naive fashion, that I could have a friendship with him and not fall for him. But mm-hmm. I mean, especially as women, it's the friendship that grabs our hearts. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. and I was unwilling to see that, and very much a slippery slope. You just get going deeper and deeper until mm-hmm. you're in boiling water and you mm-hmm. are in big trouble.
Yeah. Well, and I think it's interesting, you guys said this from the get-go, that there are, you don't have to be a believer to be, by anyone's definition, a mm-hmm. good guy. Mm-hmm. There are nice guys out there. There are moral guys out there. Mm-hmm. There are kind men out there.
Well, my mom actually said that. She said, you know what? It wouldn't be a temptation for you if he was a drug addict with no
right.
job,
right.
you know, who beat you.
Jerk.
Like,
yeah.
the mm-hmm. temptation precisely is the mm-hmm. fact that he has so many things that mm-hmm. you were hoping for.
Yeah.
But he doesn't have the most important thing, and that's what really matters.
Right. And it's interesting because my sister was in the same place dating a guy who treated her so yeah. well. And yeah. that was the thing. She had dated Christian guys who were jerks, and this guy treated her so well and affirmed her. Mm-hmm.
And was intentional, probably.
Said, yeah, was very intentional, was just, you know, constantly said, elevated her worth, you know, mm-hmm. and just talked about how she was such a catch and she was so wonderful, and she had never received that affirmation.
Well, and also just with Christian guys, there's so much more guarded about giving affirmation. Mm. Like, they're not as easy to say, oh, you look very nice today, or, you know, they're like, have the lust right. blinders on, and they're like, yeah. I can't talk about this because if I look at her butt and it looks nice, I can't tell her.
Yeah.
But, you know, with a non-Christian guy who's a good guy, he's like, you look very nice today, like, I'm very attracted to you. And a Christian guy mm-hmm. is like, not really gonna say that because he's like trying to be Christian and whatever. And it's like, okay, well, if I've got this nice guy,
he'll just compliment you on your heart.
Yeah. You just so like, that doesn't really do
heart.
It for me chemistry wise when yeah. you say I have a nice
yeah.
heart.
Yeah.
And so again, I just think there's that's that other piece to this, right? Is that they're more yeah. open to complimenting you about things that yeah. really make you go, that makes
yeah.
me feel
well,
good.
Well, and for me, I think it was, we had such great deep conversations
yes.
because
mm-hmm.
he was asking those bigger questions mm-hmm. that for me, going to a Christian college and dating Christian men, even in high school, it was like we agreed on everything and we had the same viewpoints on everything. So here was this intellectual man who had questions about things that I'd never questioned before. So, And there too, I'm like, oh, this is a good thing. He's stretching me, but maybe not in the right direction.
Yeah. Well, what would you guys say? I mean, you've alluded to this a little bit, but ultimately against your, you know, Monica, your mom's advice, against what you knew was right, against what kept you in these relationships? What was the hold? I mean, was it kind of like you got so far in and then you realized I can't get out? Or was it just like, no, I genuinely feel a connection with this guy? What was the hold on you in this?
For me, it was a little weird. I thought if I break up with him, I'm almost saying, well, then you're never going to be a Christian, and sucks to be you.
Yeah.
You know, right. And it was almost like
oh, no, you need me.
Exactly. Okay. Right. And so I almost thought, well, I would rather him break up with me, because then I didn't reject him and almost take away his pot, which is an arrogant thing to think. Yeah. You know,
that feel like you're spiritualized that one, Monica.
Without me, he'll never meet
Jesus.
Well,
you're like Jesus for him. Yeah. It's kind of like, okay, if he doesn't have me, then he's not going to have Jesus.
Right.
And so that's so ridiculous, but that's what you think. And for me, it was the investment, right? Mm-hmm. I've made such an investment in this person. I've become very attached to this person. Mm-hmm. And you start to get all these really dreamy ideas of, okay, well, love will conquer all. Like, it's like, you know, it's going to be the blanket that makes everything work between my family and eventually, you know, all of that stuff. And you do feel like, okay, if I'm not there, who's really going to be initiating Jesus in his life? But that's not your role.
No. Mm-hmm.
And you make it your role as a woman. You want to fix, you know, you want to make sure everyone's okay and all of that. But that's not
your
role.
My mom would pray. Would tell me, why don't you just pray that a good guy comes into his life who won't get emotionally involved with him, and you know, God can bring another Christian. You know, and
yeah,
it was just hard for me because I mean, at that point, I also thought, well, I can never love again. You know, like this is it. So now all my dreams of family and of children are gone.
Yeah,
because sometimes those Christian guys just don't. They don't have the boldness. I guess that's what I'm saying. They're not as bold as non-Christian guys. So is anyone really going to be that bold and pursue me like that and really tell me all the things that you're really truly dying to hear emotionally?
Yeah.
And so...
And sometimes there's a lower investment there. I mean, I will say, honestly, you know, because, okay, guys that are listening, you know, do hear this out, you know, listen, because there is some truth to that. I often say with non-Christian guys, because I've been asked out at Walmart, and I'm like, seriously, you don't know a thing about me, okay? But it's
was
like,
he the greeter?
Well, it wasn't a greeter. It was a guy in the card aisle, bless his heart. He had a very good pickup line. But it's very much like, you know, for non-Christian guys, sometimes there's that lower risk level because maybe it is just, you know, let's be honest, a booty call or whatever, you know? I mean, but whereas Christian guys, it's almost like, oh my goodness, can I marry her? And so can we do coffee? So, okay, let's talk about that. But I want to talk a little bit about, and Monica, you alluded to this. Were you ever at some point in the relationship flat out confronted by someone who was like, this is not okay? And did you ignore it? Did someone speak into your life who feared for you in this, and how did you react?
Oh, my parents did. My parents did a good job of not saying, like, you're not allowed to see him or, you know, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. But my mom was kind of like the drip, drip, drip. Mm-hmm. But it was when my dad finally sat me down and I was planning a trip to see him. I was in Puerto Rico, who was in New Jersey at the time. So I was planning a trip to spend New Year's with him. Mm-hmm. And my dad sat me down. He's like, I'm going to take you to the airport, you know, and drop you off. But I want you to know this is not the right thing. Mm-hmm. He is not a Christian. You are disobeying God. Mm. And...
Ouch.
You know, my dad's a pastor, too. Mm-hmm. So it's like my spiritual leader in two ways, you know, sat down. And that just literally put the fear of God in me. Mm-hmm. Like, that freaked me out in every good way.
Mm-hmm. Ooh, see, that kind of did the opposite for me. So my dad sat me down, too. You know, your friends are like, I can't see you go through with this. Like, this is not right. You know, but my dad sat me down and was like, I'm really worried for you. Like, I'm very fearful that you're giving your heart away to somebody who is not going to be respectful of you, you know, physically in the long. Like, I'm worried about what you guys are doing physically. Mm-hmm. Awkward conversation with dad. I mean, but then also in the long run, like, I mean, who's going to really lead your family? And for me, I was very defensive, like, okay, I need to fight for this all the more and prove people wrong. Like, I haven't been wasting my time. Mm-hmm. This guy is going to come around. He's almost there. We've had so many great conversations. Yeah. Like, you know, he's on the cusp, right? Mm-hmm. And so I was, because I don't want that to be a waste of my time.
It's enough for another day. Mm-hmm. Not enough that you're ceiling to deal, you know,
right.
with the
Lord. Yeah, so, yeah.
Yeah, for me, I feel like I kept that part a secret because... it started overseas, and then when I came back to the U.S. after my study abroad program, we continued a relationship as best we could over Skype and phone and email and everything. And I just kind of left that part out. They'd ask if he was a Christian, and I would be like, well, his dad's a pastor, and then leave it at that.
Nice.
You know, so I, like, never had to go there. And actually, I was an intern at Boundless when there were two other girls who were interns with me, and we were talking about it, and I just told them, and that was the first time someone had confronted me about it, and they were like, Chelsea, this isn't going to work. Mm-hmm. They're like, close your eyes and visualize going to church by yourself with your kids and your husband not leading you. And I was just like, with my gut, I just could feel it. I was like, ooh. Mm-hmm. And I got really defensive, of course, but that kind of stuck with me, and I started to think about it, because I don't think I had my mind so set on he was going to convert. Mm-hmm. You know, this was going to happen. He was going to become a believer and we were going to be fine. But I had never even let my mind go to that option of, but what if he doesn't? Mm-hmm. Or what if he just does it now so that we can be together? And then 5 years down the road.
Because some guys do that. Mm-hmm. Yeah. They'll go to church with you. You know, I dated someone who was Catholic. So we would go to mass at his church. And then my dad was a evangelical free church pastor. So then we'd go to my church, you know. And I was like, oh, this could totally... We're going to church. We're doing the thing. But then when you get actually married to a Christian, like we are now, you look back and you think, I was an idiot. Like, it is so nice to have my husband sitting next to me, and he wants to be there. Yeah. He's taking notes. He would be here if I was out of town. And it's such a difference, because you think you'd be dragging that guy to church, but you don't see it as that. No. You see it as the mission at that time, you know? And so... But when, in hindsight, you're like, man, I was so dumb.
You know, and I, just to piggyback on that, I think for me, like, what made that difference was thinking the first act as a mom. Like, I've wanted to be a mom since I was three, you know, myself. So the first act as a mom I'm going to do is to pick a dad for my children. And I could not, I would freak out when I would think, How can I marry a guy who doesn't know the Lord, and how are we going to raise kids? You know, and so kind of now that I'm married, now that I have two kids, and I see my husband with them, and he you know, we take them to church and we sacrifice, and, you know, and teach them, you know, we read little Bible storybooks to them and whatnot, and he's fully on board and he gets the spiritual aspect of that. Like, I thank the Lord so much that he saved me from myself back when I was very willing to run and make a stupid mistake, you know, because now you see the importance of it.
Well, let's turn a corner and talk about that, because you all are now married and you're not married to these guys.
No.
You all are married.
Praise
the Lord.
Thank you.
You're all married to believers. Okay. And first of all, you know, well, I don't want to cast, you know, the idea that, oh yeah, this is just going to work out for everyone. And of course you're not going to make a bad decision. I mean, I know women that have married unbelievers. One of the ladies at my church, in fact, married an unbeliever at 28 and decided she was going to do that. And she's now in her 70s, and he has become increasingly hostile to her faith and has really walked a very, very hard road. But I want to ask you, ladies, first of all, let's tell the stories here of how you got out of these relationships. How did you finally extricate yourself? What was the point? What was the, was it a breaking point, a tipping point, or was it finally just recognizing, you know, this isn't going to work or whatever? What did that look like?
For me, I think I was very grateful, because of the long distance, it kind of came to this point of, you know, one of us is going to have to move, but always, I mean, I would have been willing to move, and I think he would have been willing to move, but it was that one thing we couldn't agree on. And at the end of the day, he's like, I'm not going to become a Christian just so that we can be together. And we would always get so close and have these conversations where, you know, he knew all the things I believed, and he just wouldn't accept it, because he knew his life would change. His lifestyle would have to change. And I don't think he was prepared for that. And, you know, in my head, I was always just screaming, but it's so much more awesome on the other side. You just don't get it. And so it ended so quickly. It was just one conversation of, you know what? Like, we can't do this anymore. And our families would never be supportive of it. And that was really important to me, too, at the time. And so that ultimately was the thing that ended the relationship, but the distance definitely helped.
I think two things happened for me. I think the guilt became so much that I became miserable, because everything was a slippery slope. As strong as I was and as convicted as I was, there were still things that were causing me to really flirt with things that I shouldn't be flirting with. And So that was really hard. So I became miserable. But then also I'm the kind of person that's like, I'm going to make this happen. I'm going to make this work. And I think at the end of the day, the Holy Spirit really had to rip that relationship apart. And so instead of me submitting to the Lord and saying, you're right, this conviction that you're giving me, I'm not listening to. And the Lord loved me enough, thankfully, to really pry me. And when I say pry, I feel like I envision eagle claws, like ripping me out of that relationship. And it was so painful and so hurtful. And I was so upset and angry with God. And when I look back, I get pretty emotional about it because he loved me enough to not let me stay in that relationship. And so it looked like this being a problem over here for him and this being a problem for me, and then him breaking it off, but always coming back around because he knew I was a good girl. And it was just incredibly painful. And so, but I'm grateful that the Lord was like, I'm not going to let you continue in this. But I was so determined. And if I could give some advice, it would be follow that conviction that the Holy Spirit gives you. Like, don't try and fight the Holy Spirit because it will be incredibly painful.
Yeah. And I mean, I can echo so much of what Bree's saying. I was miserable. I knew in my heart, you know, and I might have not projected that externally to my parents, right. But I knew in my heart what I was doing was wrong. And I knew that this was going nowhere. But in another sense, like, we were getting closer and closer to engagement, and he was looking for rings, and we were talking about rings, and, you know, and so I was just praying and just asking God, you know, have him, you know, put an end to this. And so, and he finally did. If it never gets any better, can you accept me as I am? And I had to tell him, no, you know, I can't do this. And it was, I mean, horrendous. I was absolutely destroyed as my first boyfriend, and all I had ever wanted was to get married and have kids, and
that was over.
I thought I would never love again. I thought, you know, I wrestled with anger with God too. You know, and here God is saving my life. And I was kicking and screaming and fighting him, and but looking back on that, I'm so thankful, because that's when my faith became mine. Like, growing up a pastor's kid, it's easy to inherit your faith. I owned it, and I own it now because of that. Like, it cost me, and it's good when your faith costs
you. But it costed you your confidence in Christ, because you're thinking that this guy, you're making this guy the everything. Like, if you don't have him and you have to break up with him, you're making him everything. You're making him that idol in your life, and you're you are allowing him to replace. You're misplacing your trust. I'm trusting this guy to be the guy that I marry and have kids with, versus I trust the Lord to be bigger in my situation and bigger in my life. And God is so much bigger than the relationship, but you've made the relationship bigger than
God. And it's almost, you know, like Monica's saying, it's not even at that point as much about the guy as the hopes and dreams that are attached to him. The fact that Monica never thought that she would have another story, the fact that God would not redeem this. She was probably, you know, like, oh my goodness, I guess I'm just single the rest of my life, because this certainly won't come around again. You know, and it's like, it's hard for us to believe that God has something better when the thing that we're settling for, we think, is so great.
And you don't think you're settling at the time.
Yeah,
exactly.
But you are.
Yeah. Well, never had I had such an emotional connection with someone. It's like, oh, he gets me. He gets me on this level that no one ever will. So when we broke up, I remember thinking, I'm sacrificing this. Like, I may have a husband in the future someday who, like, is a Christian, whatever. Like, we can go to church together, but he'll never get me this way. And it was like, God has just blown my mind with how he had prepared something so much greater.
Well, and again, it's an example of God saying, let me get you. Okay.
Yeah.
You know, not, you know, until God, until you understand that God gets you, and everything that you have, whether it's in marriage or whatever, is going to be met in Jesus Christ, you're not going to be able to give to these guys and or receive from them on that level. Okay. Last minute here. I want you guys to talk about, because again, we've cast a story. You guys are now happily married with, you know, with cute kids and whatever. And, you know, that's just great. And all these women are like, well, certainly, you know, you're going to call me to let go of this relationship. But what if I don't get the stories that these women have? And I want you to talk just a little bit about, there were probably very real consequences. Like, could you re-script this? You probably would not go through all this pain and drama and whatever. I mean, you probably, I mean, for some, there are physical consequences, boundaries you gave up. For some, there's emotional attachments, things that run through your head with these guys, you know, that you can't get over easily, even though you're now happily married. What would you say? What were some of the consequences that you've had to reap as a result?
I would say, yeah, because it was such a deep emotional connection, it was really hard to break everything off because it was like, oh, one email's okay. Mm. You know, one text is okay. We can keep in communication just a little bit because I felt so responsible for his salvation. So I was like, well, even now, sometimes I'd be like, I wonder if he's a Christian. Maybe I should email him. You know, like, it's just check a up thing. On him. Like, mm-hmm. is he okay? Mm-hmm. And not really trusting the Lord that he's in his hands mm-hmm. and he will bring somebody else into his life. And so I think what I would just say is don't even test those waters. Like, if you know, don't go there. Don't. We as women attach emotionally so easy and we fall in love so easily. And I don't regret it because I know God redeemed it and has done so many things in my life because of that. But if I could go back, you know, that was definitely not a wise decision.
I think the biggest consequence, and I'll be very honest here, is physically, when I finally found my husband and we did it right, the relationship right, and we set really hard physical boundaries and all of that stuff. To be perfectly honest, for the first couple years, it was very hard not to think about that previous boyfriend mm-hmm. when you got all of those physical emotions stirred back up. And it's one of the biggest regrets of my life is continuing to date non-Christians that I thought were really going to get there, because you have that emotional scrapbook that's just, you have these heart kind of pulses, right? So something gets triggered with your husband that you're doing physically, and then all of a sudden, like, oh, I remember when I did this mm-hmm. with so and so. And honestly, it's the worst feeling to feel like you cannot focus on your husband because you did something so dumb with somebody that didn't even deserve that. And so you've sacrificed that sacred emotion with your husband for somebody that really should never had any part in that. And so that was something that was a very hard consequence for me and my relationship. And just also, then you play the comparison game, mm-hmm. not only physically, but emotionally. And then what you're doing is you're taking the person that God has designed for you, and then you're comparing that person. And you're also saying, well, I did get fed in this way here, or I did get this here. And so in the low points of your marriage, when you're not connecting and where the work actually comes in, your mind can start to drift to, okay, well, then I got this here. So why am I getting this, you know, not getting this here? And then it can actually make that, you know, mm-hmm. get that divide.
Drive the wedge,
yes, mm-hmm. the wedge larger. And mm-hmm. so I just one of the biggest regrets mm-hmm. of my life. And it's something you continually have to work through in your marriage. And you should never have to do that if you had sacrificed, you know.
Right. That's applicable to even dating Christian guys.
Mm-hmm. Oh,
when
yes.
you cross
yeah,
boundaries
of course.
Any kind.
No, and I mean, everything that Bree said, I would agree with. It's kind of like that analogy where you tape, you know, where you glue mm-hmm. two pieces of paper together and you try to tear them apart, and mm-hmm. they'll never tear cleanly. Mm-hmm. And mm-hmm. that's so true, you know, and now it's like you have to guard your heart more. You know, this is all in the past. I am so thankful mm-hmm. that never materialized, but yet I still have to guard my heart, mm-hmm. you know, and not go on Facebook and look them mm-hmm. up or, you know, mm-hmm. that kind of thing, because it... Your past is so accessible nowadays. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And that's so true.
You know, and you have to focus on the here and now. Mm-hmm. And because marriage is amazing and it's wonderful, it's also hard work. And there's mm-hmm. also moments where you're not getting along, mm-hmm. you know. And so what are you going to do in that moment? You have to choose your husband continuously. And I wouldn't have to be in that situation had I not been stupid earlier.
Because mm-hmm. things get broken, right? Mm-hmm. And so then you present to your husband, who is God's chosen for you, these broken pieces. Mm-hmm. So like the first couple years of my marriage, I emotionally could not connect in ways that I did with these previous guys because I had like thrown it all into that relationship. And it's like that part of my heart just would not work for my husband. Mm-hmm. And it's like that really, really is tough mm-hmm. because this is the one person you want it to work for mm-hmm. and you wasted it on somebody else. And so, yeah,
well,
it's a big
say
consequence.
Too, one quick word of advice if you have friends who are dating non-believers, because we like to get defensive of the relationships we're in, don't go up to them and be like, hey, you are so stupid. What are you doing? This is dumb. Like, mm-hmm. find a better way to approach it, because I think that can make people even more defensive. And I know, like, we
yeah.
all kind of talked about
prove
in our cases,
yeah.
we tried to fix it even more and prove that the relationship mm-hmm. was going to be okay. Mm-hmm. So even though you may think that they're stupid and they probably know it in the back of their mind, just be sensitive to it
and
because
just
our
pray
hearts.
For them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The Holy Spirit
yeah.
will get them.
Yeah.
yeah. I would also say, too, you know, and we'll wrap here. One thing that I've talked with my friends about and we're passionate about now is before you get get in a relationship, find three people in your life. I mean, hopefully one of them is married. If you have an older man in your life, you know, like a father that you trust, or a guy in your church or whatever, maybe a best friend as well. But three people that you give authority to tell you no. Mm-hmm. And do it in the sane times when you're sane, exactly. That you yes. know if you get in a relationship that is not right, that is not godly, that is not whatever, if those three people agree that you need to break it off, you that you contract with them, that you will do it.
Contract.
Get the covenant, you know. So anyway, awesome. Ladies, thank you so much for your transparency. Thanks for walking this road with us and walking back with us in this. And hopefully it'll allow people right now who are in bad relationships to get some clarity that they need in order to extricate themselves from that. We will be praying for you, but also look forward with hope. Again, there is hope for your future. God has that for us. You know, we don't know how our stories are going to be scripted out, but we know that God wants them, you know, to be whole and to be centered on Him. So thanks so much, you ladies.
Thanks.
Before we knew of our great need, you cared for us. You cared for us. You have buried sin and death deep in the dust. Deep in the dust. You call us out from our sleep and we run to you. Your death awakens me to life and my heart starts beating. My heart starts beating and the songs arise to you. And my heart starts beating, heart starts beating. You make us collide. You make us collide. You make us collide. You make us collide.
Well, folks, we are here with another culture segment here at The Boundless Show, and it's always our way of introducing you to some of the latest and greatest in the way of books or products or bands or whoever we have out there that we think is cool and we want to let you know about. And today is no exception. I have got Jeff Schinnebarger with me. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, it's great to be on the show.
Well, very fun to have you. Jeff is a number of different things. We're going to actually be talking about his book, More or Less, today, which I had a lot of fun reading. But when he's not writing books, he is a social entrepreneur. He actually is co-founder of the Q event, for those of you that have gone to that. And he's the creative director at Catalyst. I know many of you have gone to Catalyst, as have I. And he's also the founder of GiftCardGiver.com and Plywood People. And he and his fam live in Atlanta. So a little bit about Jeff. So kind of interesting. I mean, in light of all that stuff that he's done, the topic of this book is kind of fun, More or Less, Choosing a Lifestyle of Excessive Generosity. And Jeff, when I was kind of introing this at the front end of the show, I said, you know, everyone just needs to go out and, you know, have their last hurrah being super selfish and just gathering all their stuff and spending their money the way they want, because then they're going to be challenged to do that differently after talking to you. But I wanted to talk to you just first. I mean, why don't we just start by casting the vision for how this book even came about? Because there aren't a lot of like entrepreneurs and people that are kind of movers and shakers. And, you know, I know you alluded in the book to you have your iPhone, so it's not like you're just living on some desert island. But how really you got the vision for this?
Yeah, well, related to like what you were saying earlier about getting rid of everything or all selfish ambitions or whatever, but I think I try to write this in a way where people are not feeling guilty about what they have necessarily, or feeling like just because they have something they should feel bad, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The truth is, like, I come from a middle class family. I always, for the most part, could get what I really wanted to if I worked hard. You know, my wife and I have two cars. We have a house with three bedrooms and two bathrooms. We have a lot of luxuries. I use an iPhone. I use Apple products, you know. and deep down, I really oftentimes want more than what I currently have. And that's a tension that I feel in my life. And it really came to a front for me when I started a relationship with a neighbor of mine. His name is Clarence. And he's a homeless neighbor that welcomed me to my neighborhood the second day we were there. And he rang the doorbell and basically said he could do yard work for me if we needed that. And from that first day, it was really the first time I ever had to wrestle with how to love my neighbor when my neighbor had no home. And it was a great tension of me realizing how much I have been given and what my responsibility is with that to others. And that was kind of the start to this journey for me and my wife.
Yeah. And I like how you kind of tell in the book how that relationship developed. And it wasn't about you saying, okay, now I know Clarence, so let me, quote, fix him up and get him a place to stay and get him a job. And all you had to kind of meet him where he was and all of his own preferences and the way that he wants to live his life and yet still love him and help him meet needs in the midst of that.
Yeah, it was definitely a relationship that was probably as much frustrating as fulfilling, you know, mm-hmm. like, I can't change his living situation, and if I tried to, it would never work. You know, it was just really meeting him with where he was, and I think more than anything, like when he would come to my front door, and he knocks on the door or rings the doorbell, and very quickly he looks in my house and sees the abundance that I have, and I look back at him and see, you know, he has the clothes on his back. And I think there's something really healthy about relationships like that that make you realize how much you've been given. I don't know about you, but for me, one thing I've realized is that when I hang out with people that have more than I have, I tend to want more. Mm-hmm. And when I hang out with people that have less than I have, I tend to simplify my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I was trying to spend too much time with more influential people, people that had more money, more things, more stuff. And I was desiring more when really I had more than I probably need. And having relationships with people that have less than me, it was really challenging me in new ways.
Yeah. Well, you actually say that really the book is showing us how to combat a culture that inflates our idea of what we need. And I think it's funny because it's not, you know, I don't often sit around and say, okay, do I really have all that I need? And I'm sure, you know, is it just I want to make sure that I only have what I need and not what I want? I mean, I just put it all in the same bucket and I'm like, pretty much what I want is what I need. So, you know, I think it's interesting because you actually ask the question in the book about what really is enough. How do we delineate between what we need and what we want? What is actually enough and will we ever have enough? And can you talk a little bit about what, I mean, obviously this has been a process for you, but what did your life look like before? And then what have you actually realized in determining for your own needs? You know, because you have to provide, you're providing for a family as well. And obviously you have to be on the same page as your wife with this. You know, it's not just like, hey, I'm going to do this. And your wife's like, ah. So how did you wrestle with that and come to this idea for yourself of what do I actually need?
Yeah. I mean, there's AT&T runs all these commercials that say more is better. That's the tagline that they use. And that's, I mean, if you start paying attention to billboards and advertising, everything tells us to get more and more and more and to not stop, to keep pursuing and wanting more. And so, you know, in defining enough, the truth is, like, I can't define that for you. It's a subjective definition. If you looked up in a dictionary, it would be a subjective definition. Enough is not a definitive answer. And so I think the challenge is most of us don't ever really want to wrestle with that question, what is enough for our own lives? And so I had to start to wrestle with that for me in really practical ways. What is enough time at work? What is enough time with my family? What is enough time, you know, working out? What's enough time doing, you know, all these different categories of our time management? Most of us are not really that great at that. Or what is enough giving, you know, I think we're taught a lot of times to give based on percentages and things like that. But is that enough, or is that just what we're told? I think if you ask that question in every aspect of life, it'll truly transform how you live. It's challenging. It might not be exciting always, but it's something we're continually wrestling with. And my wife, I would be honest, my wife could live a lot more simply than I probably could. So it was easier mm-hmm. conversation. She would probably challenge me to desire less, you know,
mm-hmm.
and live on less. So she, in that conversation, it was way easier to wrestle with that with her.
Yeah. Well, I like the story that you cast, and I want you to talk a little bit about you give enough experiments throughout the book that kind of challenge us to take what you're saying to a practical level and actually start implementing some of the things where we realize, wow, you know, this probably is a good mechanism, not only for me addressing the things in my own life, but then recognizing how I can help others. But you talked about doing this experiment with food in your house, and I know you say you don't encourage everyone to just do this or figure out how they could do it, but talk about how that just opened your eyes to really what you had actually being more than enough.
Yeah, well, I think the hope in all this is that we become more generous in our lives. And I think, like, most people have this value that they desire to be generous people. I think we all know someone that's generous, that gives more than they receive, and we've all benefited in some way from that. But we struggle with knowing how to begin a life of generosity. And so we encourage people to do these social experiments and to really start to understand what we've been given as a baseline and to try to live on less. And so my wife and I did this experiment. I challenged her, what if we didn't go grocery shopping? And she thought it was a little bit crazy. And so we agreed to get milk. That was the only thing we bought. But we basically just lived on what was in our food pantry and in our freezer. And so we started off, we were eating really healthy. We had all these kind of frozen meats that we worked through and frozen vegetables. And then you kind of get to the shelves that have the noodles and all the spaghetti options. And eventually, like, we had pancakes four times. You know, it's not a very healthy experiment. We each gained like 7 pounds, but we made it through. And
it's when you start getting to the condiments that it's problematic. It's like a dinner of ketchup and relish and
Yes, or the Bisquick muffins that you can make, you know. Mm-hmm. But ultimately, we lasted 7 weeks without going grocery shopping. And that's 147 meals we lasted, just under 7 weeks. And that was times two. So 147 meals times two, that's a lot of food that we had. And, you know, the thing that we all do is we come home from work after a long day, we look in the refrigerator and you say to your spouse, there's nothing here to eat, right? How many times have we all said that? But yet, our family, we had more than enough food. We just wanted more options. And so what we started realizing is, you know, through that experiment, we also had this relationship with Clarence and realizing, wow, when Clarence comes to our front door, if he needs a sandwich, we probably have something that we could give him, not out of handouts, but out of relationship, because we knew Clarence for years, you know. Mm-hmm. And if you were coming to our house, we'd offer you food, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was an interesting experiment to start to realize how much we have been given and what we could do for others out of that.
Yeah. Well, and you actually, at one point, Clarence came to your door, I think it was in the rain, and you had to completely outfit him with clothes.
Yeah, it was pouring down rain, and I asked him that night, you know, what could I do for him? And he asked for some dry clothes and a gift card. You mentioned the gift card giver, because we always had gift cards, the gift card to McDonald's. Mm-hmm. So he could just get some food and wait out the rainstorm. And I remember that day walking back to my closet and looking at all the socks I had. I had like close to 10 pairs of shoes in my closet, and, you know, I had all these jackets. And it was just this realization that I have so much, you know, and I could give a full outfit to Clarence, including shoes, and it wouldn't change my life at all, you know. There would be no tension in it. It would just be giving it away to him. Hmm. And so, you know, there's all these experiments around clothes that people have done, too, where they start to see how long they could go without wearing the same thing twice. And we have these, the point is, we have all these things in our lives that we have in excess that aren't even related to money. Most people, when they talk about generosity, they think it's all about money. And oftentimes money is the last thing you give. It's what do you have in your life right now that is in excess that could help someone else that's in great need. And out of that, you can really start to gain a lifestyle of generosity.
Yeah. And let's talk about a couple of the experiments, because a few of them, I was just telling Martha, our producer, you know, I'm like, oh, we got to start doing some of these. This would be fun. And I think she kind of looked at me like, okay. So
what's the first one you're going
to
do?
Well, okay. First of all, the first one for me is something that I would just love to do anyway. And that's the one where you talk about just giving out of your excess, starting to listen to people who say, if I only had, or I need this, or I, you know, I've had that, again, even with the gift card thing, you know, a family where maybe the dad's been laid off and stuff, and I've been given through a bonus here at work or whatever, I have grocery gift cards, you know, and as a single person, that's not something I quote need all the time. I mean, what I need to do is start eating at home more often instead of going out to eat. Let's be honest about that. But anyway, just being able to say, oh my word, I have a $25 gift card. Or a friend of mine who said, you know, well, I wanted to start running and it would be great, you know, I mean, but I just can't, I'm not going to be able to afford, you know, getting music or getting an MP3 player. And I'm like, ah, funny you should mention it. I have an iPod Shuffle that now that I use my iPhone, I don't need, you know, that kind of stuff. And just cluing myself into the stuff that I have. That why do I still have it? Oh my goodness, I was slain by your example of I have this bucket of stuff in case there's ever an 80s party again. I have that bucket. I have that bucket of like costume props of things I've accumulated because you never know when you're going to have an ugly sweater party or an 80s party, or I'm just so prepared for all of those things. And just any number of things. I mean, the things that really I could get rid of that I don't need, but they're my in case kind of things. You know, you talk about that. So I think yeah. That first one's a great one.
Yeah, that's a, you know, that's an example of like just learning from your community what are needs that people have. Of, I mean, I think a practical one is like tools sometimes for guys listening to have a whole bunch of tools in their shed, and there's someone that needs a special tool for a special time. You know, they need a chainsaw, and if you have a chainsaw, why wouldn't you just let that person use it and give it to them for a while? You know?
Yeah. Yeah. All these people that are going out buying chainsaws when they don't need to, you should just borrow it from someone.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And so that's a really cool experiment to really start to listen to the people around you. There's an experiment with clothes that someone did named Ashley. She wanted to see how many days she could go without wearing the same thing twice. And she lasted 156 days with her tops. Mm-hmm. And it sounds crazy, but you forget how many free T-shirts you have. You forget how many special occasion outfits you have. You forget what all is in your closet. The last day, the last thing she wore was an old bridesmaid dress that was maroon satin, you know. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was perfect. She went bowling the last day to celebrate. I think there's a lot of experiments that people have done. I knew someone that even just wore their T-shirts. See how many days they could go just in T-shirts, and they lasted something like 4 months. Mm-hmm. And that's probably been the most exciting thing for me with the book, is hearing stories of experiments and things that people have decided to do since reading it, where, you know, I don't know what you have in excess. You have something. It might be clothes. It might be time. It might be an extra bedroom in your house that no one uses, you know. What mm-hmm. if you could contribute that to someone that really needs it? Mm-hmm. In some way, I think those are that's the amazing part about generosity. Like, we have been given these things, and if we look and are aware of the needs that are around us in our community, we can really be living a life of generosity.
Yeah. I like what you say in the clothes experiment as well of, you know, don't just cast off a bunch of stuff that you've just been too lazy to get rid of and you know you don't like it and you never wear it, but pick an item that you actually love and give that also, and just, you know, see what it means for you to actually part with something that, you know, yeah, this, I maybe don't need this, you know, in that sense. I thought that was a good suggestion as well, to give your favorite, I think you called it. I thought that was good. Let's talk a little bit about the other one that I think I'm going to do is finding something in my house and selling it and giving the money to charity. Because I think, you know, it's funny. We just have had a number of fires here in Colorado Springs, and a lot of people have lost their homes. And I remember it caused me last year when we had the Waldo Canyon fires here to assess if I had to grab stuff out of my house, what would I grab? And I realized that I don't really have a lot of stuff of value. I certainly don't have jewelry. I don't, you know, I'm not a big collector of whatever. But I do have several things that that probably I could get money for, you know, and they're just things that I don't necessarily need. They're things that easily I could get some money for. And so I thought, you know, that's something I have a number of lithographs that I've collected that aren't even, they're still like in their boxes, you know, and it's like, honestly, I could throw those things on eBay and probably get a good amount of money for them. So so just a couple examples of things I'm going to think of there, too.
Yeah. Yeah, and I've heard a lot of stories of people that really just go into their basement or their attic or the closet where they keep all the stuff that they haven't used in a couple of years and just do a garage sale with it.
Yeah.
And say, hey, out of this money, we can contribute to this organization, this person that needs it. I've heard of people doing that to support a person that was going into the mission field. I've heard of it supporting, there's a website you can look up called garagesalesfororphans.com, mm-hmm. where they've found a new way to fund orphan, you know, care for orphans overseas in Haiti and other places.
Yeah.
And it's just by saying, hey, do a garage sale and whatever you make that day can go to this need.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think a lot of people deeply want to be generous. They just don't know where to begin. And when you start to see what you have been given and you give to others, there's a great snowball effect that happens. You want to give more.
Yeah, that's great. And I know you actually, I think, furnished your first apartment, right, on the generosity of others, people who were just, we don't need this thing anymore.
Absolutely. I had this theory. I think my wife is a little embarrassed by this, but I had this theory that when we were engaged, everyone wanted to bring us over for dinner and give us marriage advice. This is very common when you get engaged. And I had a theory. I said, why don't we ask everyone what is one piece of furniture in their house that they hate? And I bet every single person listening to this has a piece of furniture in their house. It might be a side table. It might be a chair. It might be a lamp. It could be a desk, maybe your bed. But if we would just agree to take it, literally bring a truck and take it from their house, that they would just give it to us.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, within 2.5 months of these dinners, we had an entire apartment filled with furniture. We didn't buy a single thing.
Huh.
You know, we would say, I have this theory, and people would say, oh yeah, the husband and wife would look at one another like, oh yeah, that desk, they need to take it. Will you take it away from us? You know, mm-hmm. It was great.
That's funny. So what personally has been your hardest excess to part with, would you say?
Wow, that's the first time I've gotten that question. I think the hardest thing for me personally has been this tension. It's kind of a root issue, which is this tension of me valuing that I am good enough.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily a thing. Like, I started realizing in this process that I will never have enough until I believe I am good enough.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's kind of a root issue, that we try to mask this issue of self-identity with buying things or eating more or, you know, or working out more to feel good about myself. But when in reality, like, God made me something special, something unique that no one else is. And until I come to grips with that, I will never have enough. And I don't think that that's like an easy, like, it doesn't happen just overnight where I'm all okay about myself. You know, I think it's a constant tension of battling your own insecurities to determine that there's value in who I am and my responsibility here on earth.
Yeah. Well, I noticed that you didn't do that photo experiment. You talked about the photo experiment where you just take a picture of yourself in the morning with no props, no makeup, no combing your hair or whatever. And you haven't done that yet. So you might.
I have not done that one yet.
You might need to do that. And we're going to be your accountability. And then you have to, like, let us know here at the Boundless Show about that. You know,
That would be tough.
You put it in the book.
Some of the creative ideas I can just put out there and encourage other people to do. I'm just kidding.
I don't know. Now you've named it.
That's the hardest thing is, you know, viewing myself and how I see myself in our culture. I think it's hard. And I think a lot of people, I think that's one of the stories that has connected with the most people, because it's the root issue in all of this. A lot of us see the bad in who we are. They don't see the potential and what God has made us to be. I think that's the tension that so many people, especially in their 20s, are struggling with.
Mm-hmm.
Why am I on earth? What am I called to do? That tension, I mean, it keeps people up late at night and it makes people feel unfulfilled. in life. And that's the wrestling that we're all going through.
Yeah. Well, and like you say, I mean, acquiring stuff and propping ourselves up with stuff is almost a drug. It's a safety, you know, and it's our ability to say, okay, well, if I busy myself with this, or if I say that I'm about this, or if I keep this, it's going to provide some kind of comfort to me or whatever. But when we really do clear it out and have a stark, you know, we live starkly, I mean, obviously symbolically with our stuff, but just really, you know, openly before one another, I think that can be very scary.
I totally agree.
Yeah. Well, Jeff, this is a fun book. It's a convicting book. I appreciate the fact that you have decided to take this journey. Not everyone has a Clarence in their life, but you all have someone in your life that is a neighbor, that is a friend, that is a coworker. It's time for us to stop, you know, avoiding people and sheltering ourselves from people and moving in our little cliques of the people that we feel are comfortable. I think it's a great challenge to all of us to live beyond ourselves, to understand you know, the generosity that the Bible calls us to and what that looks like practically. So, Jeff, I appreciate you writing the book More or Less and kind of casting a vision for us and giving us some practical steps for getting started.
Thanks. It's been great talking with you.
Well, this is a lot of fun. Again, folks, the book is More or Less, Choosing a Lifestyle of Excessive Generosity. We are obviously going to throw the book up on the blog and a link to all of Jeff's info. And we hope that you will then maybe start taking some of these challenges and letting us know how you are actually putting them into action. So, and of course, through our community, we can talk about that with one another and encourage one another and hopefully make some change through Boundless. So, Jeff, thank you so much. Again, we will also give you more info and link to what he has going on with Plywood People and through giftcardgiver.com. So thanks again, Jeff, for being part of this conversation.
Great.
Opening up this week's inbox, I have got Candace on the line. Hey, Candace.
Hi, Lisa. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. Always good to talk to you and to have you answer our questions. Let me go ahead and throw this week's out for you.
Okay.
This person is saying, none of my siblings are believers, and two of them are in fairly serious dating relationships with non-believers. I and my parents want them to marry believers, but my siblings aren't Christians, so can I even hold them to that standard? What would it mean for me to approve of their marriage to someone who isn't a believer? How can I love them and encourage them through this process? They want me to shower compliments on them for finding such an amazing person, but my heart just isn't into it.
This is a common situation, I think, in families where you have one or two or three siblings who know and are following Christ and trusting Him, and others who aren't. And I would just encourage the writer of this question that before desiring for them to marry believers, you should want them to become believers themselves. And that's where you should start in your relationship with them, praying for them and sharing the gospel with them and asking the Lord to save them. You're right. You can't expect them to marry Christians if they're not themselves following Christ. It's not something that they'll value. And really, you know, if you prayed for an unbelieving spouse to marry a believer, then you're really praying that the Lord would help the believer in the relationship who is not your sibling to sin and break God's command, which is thou shalt not be unequally yoked.
Yeah, totally.
So the focus here needs to be on praying for salvation. I think, too, it's important to remember that marriage was God's idea from the beginning. He created it in the garden for Adam with Eve, and it is a common grace that is given to any who enter into it in the way he intended it. And so I think we all know of couples who have had long-lasting, thriving marriages where there has been much human flourishing, even though those two people don't know the Lord. And that's by design, and we call that common grace. You know, it's the same principle that says God gives sunshine to people who don't know and worship him. That is a common grace, and marriage is like that. And so it's okay to recognize marriage as one of God's good gifts. You have the opportunity, though, as a believer, to share with your sibling your further conviction that marriage isn't just a good gift, but it's a good gift from someone. It's from a loving Heavenly Father. And to kind of let that be a jumping-off point to talk about your convictions about what marriage means beyond just being the place for human flourishing to being a picture of something far greater, far more mysterious that Paul talks about in Ephesians, that it's the picture of Christ and his relationship with the church.
Yeah.
So that's a good starting place. You know, if the fiancé of your sibling has virtuous character, praise that. Mm-hmm. You know, if the man that your sister is marrying and neither of them are believers is a kind and generous and honest and hardworking man, those are things that are worthy of praise. And it's okay to rejoice that she's marrying a man of high character. If, on the other hand, these two unbelievers are planning to come together and one or both of them have, you know, pathological problems, they're, you know, all sorts of character flaws, or you're concerned for her safety, these kinds of things, it doesn't matter if they're claiming to be believers or not. As a loving sister, you say, hey, I'm concerned because this guy you're marrying seems abusive, or he seems easily given to anger, or, you know, he seems lazy, or using a ton of credit cards. So I think we can, again, come back to just sort of the issue of what kind of relationship will lead to human flourishing. And it is possible to flourish in a marriage even before coming to Christ. By God's grace, I think often he uses the crucible of marriage to lead people to Christ.
Yeah, good point. And I like how you say, you know, that this person, our listener, as a believer, has a great opportunity to encourage and to speak into this relationship and to, you know, help support good principles and to, again, pray for salvation, because that will be the true tipping point. So
yeah, and to share, too, with the sibling how hard marriage is, mm-hmm. and how we need God. The reason that, you know, presumably still couples get married, most of them anyway, get married in the church. Well, what does that mean? And you can have a conversation to say, you know, marriage is really hard. And the vows that two people take before God are not vows that we can really keep very reasonably in our own strength. They're impossible vows. To stay faithful to one person who is also a imperfect person for the rest of your life, that is a tall order that is really, in fact, impossible without God's help, without his grace. And so I think there are so many gospel opportunities as you talk through this with your sibling. And really that is the place to focus your energy and your prayer, to say, Lord, please use this relationship to lead my sister or brother to faith in Christ.
Yeah. Well, great thoughts, Candace, as always. And I always appreciate your prayerful attitude, even in answering these questions and really caring about the hearts of those that are involved and ultimately seeing that God is glorified in that. So mm-hmm. that is great.
Thanks, Lisa. You're welcome. It's a privilege to do it.
Well, all right, everyone, that is it for this week's show. We hope that this has been an encouragement to you. We've kind of covered a lot here as far as how we engage with those around us through the culture. We really appreciated Jeff's interview related to that, looking at our own standards and the way that we pour into those around us. And then also, of course, touching on the dating in an unequally yoked situation. And now Candace dealing with this question related to marriage. That is it for this week. Show. Write to us at editor@boundless.org if we can talk about something in the future. We love it when you come and visit us, because we always kind of, you know, pull on people's ears. Is that an expression? Pull on someone's ears? Get their ear? Whatever. About what about the show they'd like to see more of or less of, what's really resonated with them. So we love hearing from you. Do give us feedback. That is it for this week's show. I'm your host, Lisa Anderson, for The Boundless Show.
The Boundless Show is a production of Boundless.org. Focus on family.
A donor-supported ministry of Focus on the Family.